Hello, I'm Dan Safarik. This is Unfrozen. The guest today is Lindsay Wickstrom. She's the founding principal of Mataforma and an adjunct assistant professor at Columbia University Graduate School of Architecture, Planning, and Preservation. She holds a master's in architecture from Columbia University, where she was awarded the Charles McKim Prize, Visualization Award, and the Avery Six Award. Lindsay is also the recipient of the SOM Prize. Research focuses on the history of environmentalism and the trajectory of mass timber. This is her first book. The book is called Designing the Forest and Other Mass Timber Futures. Lindsay, welcome.
Thank you so much, Dan. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I think the first thing that I would want to ask about is, I think the concept for most people who are designers but not necessarily experienced in timber would be how do you conceive of the idea of designing a forest? Because I think a lot of people just think of it as, you know, a virgin stand of timber, and we go in and we cut down trees, and that's kind of a bad thing, but it's an unavoidable aspect of modern commerce, and we've been doing it for centuries. But in fact, one does design a forest. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Definitely. That's the main question, and I love that you've stemmed, you know, that first question from the title. So it really does get to the core of why I wrote the book. You know, to say a couple of words, you know, I really was hoping that this book became a kind of guide for young designers or designers of all ages to feel like architecture and their choices when they're designing buildings or spaces, exhibitions, you know, different uses of materiality, for those decisions to feel like they have a lot of agency in the world, and that those decisions have an impact, and hopefully a positive impact, in our climate. And so when we think about climate change, you know, all of our choices when we're designers could either have positive or negative impacts, right? So when I think about designing the forest, I think about how we can specify wood or design with wood to improve the site of material cultivation in this case. So when you are, for example, the ultimate, in my opinion, would be designing with biodiverse, indigenously owned mass timber, for example. And what that means is that you're designing a space that is using mass timber, number one. So that's replacing concrete and steel in a built environment. So you're reducing significantly the embodied energy of those materials. Number two, biodiversity. That means that you're putting money in the pocket of folks that are cultivating multiple species rather than just monoculture. And then number three, potentially, you know, indigenously owned or historically discriminated folks that own forest, that is putting money in the pocket of people who interpret the value of forest in different ways. And so if you really pay close attention to the place that you get your wood when you're designing a mass timber building or structure, you can essentially be designing two places at once, a place for occupants and a place for where the material comes from. So that's the kind of implication of the title. But there's so much more to say on that note, but I'll kind of put it back on your plate.
Thank you for that. I think one of the more interesting aspects of the book is that it's split up into a couple of parts, which are separated by these sections called equivalents, where you break from the essay format to show something very starkly in graphical terms. I would say that it's black and white, but it's actually bright yellow and black. These sort of almost like a caution tape or warning sign kind of illustrations that really jump off the page. One of the first ones that you include is actually, what is the impact of one printed book and what is one impact of digital book? Architects are pretty good at self-criticism, but I've never seen something quite at this granular level and to the point of what you're actually producing and holding in your hand here. How did you arrive at the idea of doing these equivalents, and what's the sort of graphic story behind them?
I'm so glad that you're drawn to them. I I was really working closely with the graphic designer to figure out where they fit in the book because they're a kind of parallel story to the text. You kind of follow them along, or you could look at them without really ever reading the text. They're almost like a graphic book just in and of itself, folded into this other book. The idea for the equivalence came from, teaching studio at Columbia, and talking to a lot of students and folks about how we qualify climate change and how we talk about impact. There's this tendency to talk about carbon, tons of carbon, in the last, I don't know, 10, maybe it's longer than 10 years, but in my experience in the last 10 to 20 years, there's been a way to qualify impact by saying, 10 tons of carbon or 100 tons of carbon, or things like net zero. And I find a lot of those descriptions very challenging and impersonal and not very persuasive and really abstract. What is 10 tons of carbon? From where? How long? This is a complex, creating a positive impact is very complex, and it's very relative to the work that's being done. 10 tons of carbon in a really big building is actually a really small amount, versus a really tiny project would be a big amount. So there's just it's just too it's not as detailed as I would have liked. I want to help. Early on, I wanted to help students describe the impact of their projects in new ways, and so that was the inspiration for this section. And to say a little bit about what the section includes, like you shared the really funny example of qualifying the impact of a printed book, because when I would share that I was writing a book about mass timber and the impact of cultivated biogenic materials in the built environment, the first critique or lighthearted critique I would get from folks is that shouldn't you save trees by not printing? And it made me think, why do we have that assumption? Why is that an assumed savings? That assumption really excludes the value of reading, like with a physical object. It also assumes that the energy of digital storage is zero, which is not. I mean, it's just such a strange assumption. And so I was very curious, how is it really, like, is it truly worse for the environment to print on paper than to email a PDF around or save a PDF on a data server somewhere? And like you can see in the book, it's actually very similar in the amount of embodied energy that is used. So I really wanted to challenge those assumptions we have. It gets to the root of the book too about, we like what you said at the beginning, that it feels uncomfortable for people to cut down trees. It feels somehow antithetical to having a positive impact on the built on the world requires the cutting down and harvesting of trees, because we think trees are, our number one carbon absorption, technology on the planet, which they are. But the beautiful thing is that they grow back. And I think working with that cycle is a really anti-industrialized mindset, thinking cyclically and incorporating the built environment into the carbon cycle and telling that story. So, yeah, the equivalents are meant to expand on how we might start to describe that relationship.
Yeah, and it really is an industrial process, and it's an industrial process that can be improved. It's not necessarily that it's a static process. It's certainly not as disruptive and extractive as other types of mineralized approaches to construction. So there's a lot of room for improvement in the chain. I'm also interested in the social aspect of your observation and your critique, which you alluded to at the beginning of the call, where you had suggested that there is a virtuous cycle that could be introduced, perhaps both on the supply and on the construction and receiving end. I mean, one way that I've sort of thought about it in a simplistic way, although mostly as a framework for proposing research to the well-funded people in the timber industry who have so far not taken up the suggestion, was that, if you look at the big problems we have in this country, which is polarization politically, and we have people who are disadvantaged in both urban and rural environments, it seems that a well-executed timber supply chain could cut into that a bit, in the sense that you have all these, old timber towns that have shut up shop because the type of, output that they created isn't wanted by the market anymore, dwindling populations in rural areas generally. And then on the other side, of course, you've got the housing crisis and you've got, underemployment and discrimination and redlining and all kinds of the after effects of that. And, is there a synergy there to be able to train people in the collection, well, not just the collection, but the cultivation and then the manufacturing processes, which are relatively novel for the States anyway. We've had them in Europe for a while. And then create that supply chain so that it's part of a virtuous cycle that ultimately results in helping to resolve some of our housing crisis. Is that simplistic thinking? Is that a framework for thinking about this?
No, it's not simplistic at all. It's so right on the money. I mean, that could be its own book, really. I mean, the like tapping into the economic flows of wood. I mean, I touch lightly on it, but what you're describing, I think, is so like implicit in the research. I don't think I go as far to say, what I might say openly here is I do really think it's an amazing solution, an actual solution to a lot of the problems we're seeing. So not only climate change, but also the degrading of our soil nutrients across the landscape. I mean, across the global landscape, but definitely in the US. It's absolutely an economic benefit, at least, in the long term. I think the thing that I am really interested in, let's say exploring or challenging people, with the writing in the book is that when you're designing the forest and the city at the same time, you really have a multi-generational mindset. And so when we're looking at these, economic disparities that are and the political polarization that are right in front of us and changing almost on a daily basis, it's tougher to imagine how these kinds of schemes would really alter that in such an immediate way. But I am very confident that if we were to invest in this type of infrastructure today, you would see such substantial stability in the future. So it's an investment in the future. That's how I constantly think of it. And one of the inspirations for this like multi-generational thinking that I reference in the book is the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, which is a indigenous confederacy that was established in the Northeast prior to the arrival of European settlers. And they and other groups have this belief too, but they talked about the seven generation rule. And so any in that case, any economic or political or environmental decision that had to be made was made to honor the previous three generations and made to provide for the next three generations. And, I think that if we were to take that very seriously as a society, the decisions we make would be quite different. And, I kind of think that way too because forests, trees take some species, an entire person's life to mature. Like beech, for example, American beech, those trees could mature and be ready for harvest within 80 to 200 years. And so when we're thinking about plant cultivation at that scale, you know, it becomes it kind of quickly becomes a challenge of our trust in future generations. Do we, like, who do we trust to keep that going? And that's why, you know, in the book, I have a first chapter that's called Succession, and it really looks at the history of forest cultivation, and it shows that the tendency was to really trust the state or the monarchy to do the work of protecting the forest, because they considered themselves to be more multi-generational than the typical family. And so that's when policing the forest started, and your everyday person really wasn't allowed to engage in designing the forest. But now we have a strange opposite problem where, you know, especially in New York, 90% of the forest is owned privately. And so there's nothing to stop all of these private owners from just clearing their land and building townhomes, or clearing their land and, you know, raising cattle. And so there's this, you know, maybe a different sort of challenge on our doorstep, is how do we, you know, create shared forest management plans that are for our collective good, within this framework of private property. This is a kind of new American challenge. I mean, it's also global, but there's a lot, like, for Canada has a different issue, you know, and they're right next door. You know, a lot of their forest is publicly owned, so they don't really have that same challenge. You know, if we were to try to build all of the buildings in New York City out of mass timber that's locally grown and harvested, we would have the biggest problem with that idea would not be, do we have enough forest? I wrote this paper that proves that there's more than enough volume of wood in the state of New York to provide enough mass timber for that rate of construction indefinitely without ever depleting the forest. But actually, the problem would be, can you get all of these private property owners to agree that that's something that they want to do? And so I think that's what's kind of ahead of us as a nation. The Inflation Reduction Act did put a lot of investment into new manufacturing in this space, biogenic material, yeah, manufacturing, renewable energy factories. And I think if we continue to invest in that infrastructure, like you're saying, especially with smaller businesses, so vertical, well, hold on, I'll get to maybe you're getting to verticality of the chapter, but if we can invest in clusters of small businesses, then we can start to spread the wealth of this new material era around a lot better than we have in the past.
Thank you for that. Do you think that, well, let's talk about verticalization a little bit. Is this the concept that instead of having giant, you know, timber companies like Weyerhaeuser or Georgia-Pacific, you know, kind of dictating where the timber goes in the supply chain, and then it sort of gets pooled down into much smaller practices that are you know, designing and building, you're talking about pooling resources in some way so that smaller landowners can participate, but via a set of standards, it sounds like.
Yeah, it's something like that, and there's a lot of different varieties of verticalization. So the most, if we were to think of it as a spectrum, the most extreme vertical company would be like a single entity that owns the seedling production. So even sapling production is its own step in this whole process. So sapling production owns the seeds, owns seed storage, owns forests, owns sawmills, owns the manufacturing. You know, sawmills cut trees into lumber. The lumber goes to a manufacturing facility to be made into products. Owns the shipping, owns the construction company, owns the design company, maybe the development company, and maybe they're also the client. That would be the most vertical. And we know of companies that were at least trying to be that. I think that a more sustainable, well, even the word sustainable isn't great. So a more resilient option, so you know, not getting too big to fail, which inevitably generates failure, would be what are called wood clusters. And we see this in different places in like Scandinavia, where each of those steps is a different company. So the sawmill is just a sawmill, and the manufacturing plant is just a manufacturing plant, and they do, you know, they make a particular range of products. Same with the sawmill. But they're in relationship with each other, and they're protected by legislation that deems them as a wood cluster. So the government actually sees them as a vertical organization, kind of like a co-op, you know, in a brownstone or something. You know, sees it as a recognizes this as a group of individuals. And so that recognition protects them from being bought up by a bigger company, basically. In the US, we have none of those protections. And so, you know, as a small company, you're having to compete with these massive companies, and you don't have that kind of collective power that you might have in a wood cluster. And so it's inevitable that you would close your doors. I mean, sawmills, we've been losing sawmills. You know, over the last century, there's barely any left. New York has like no sawmills left, and it's because a lot of that is now just outsourced by those larger companies to Canada, where labor is a different price. And so, yeah, these larger companies aren't bad. I wouldn't say that they're, you know, good versions and bad versions. They're just different, and their motivations, their interpretation of value in the forest is different than a smaller company. You know, Weyerhaeuser, for example, is a really interesting company to study. They were the first massive company to promote regenerative forest management in the US, you know, after an era of you know, clearing happened, even when we knew we shouldn't be doing that. You know, we had, you know, a lot of those folks that were clearing had come from Europe, where regeneration was already like 1,000 years old. But coming here, there was this Western expansion that fueled a lot of just clearing and cutting without replanting. So Weyerhaeuser reminded our country we need to regenerate the forest, but the way that they're, you know, regenerating is really product oriented, not necessarily habitat oriented. And so, all that is to say is that there are just so many different ways to regenerate a forest, and I would love to see a massive variety of approaches. Like that kind of expansion of the definition of how to replant a forest and what kinds of products are possible in this essentially makes the forest more resilient, because you're not really saying, oh, we just need 2x6s from pine, that's the main product. Or you know, SPF, spruce pine fir, which is the typical input to mass timber and into all single family homes stick frame. And so if we kind of keep going down the road we're going down without incentivizing biodiversity or small business, you know, verticality, well, that's the only forest we'll have left. You know, we'll lose a lot of our hardwoods, and it'll be difficult to regrow them because of the way the forest naturally grows in succession. I'm getting off topic. Anyways, it's complicated, but I think that those kinds of ideas, I really enjoy thinking about the economics of forestry as opposed to just assuming that it's like a socialist future. You know, I really in you know, I think that it's really important that the forest is profitable. A profitable forest is not a poor forest. A profitable forest will be able to protect itself. It'll have people caring for
Yeah,
it.
that's something that's
Most
probably
likely won't burn
not
down.
also very well understood,
So
is that
those things
the more
are really important
attention
to
humans pay to a
design into it.
forest in a world in which humans have been edging out the natural landscape or going further into it and pushing those boundaries, the better off it might be, because you have those routines of clearance, you have those routines of replanting and management. So we've talked a lot about the supply side. I want to talk a little bit about the demand side, and maybe the sort of, I guess, the implementation side when it comes to construction. I think aside from the supply problems, which you illustrated quite well, there's also the issue of code. And it seems like code is coming around to understand that mass timber is going to be a viable product. But it really often seems to come down to the local fire chief and what they think about timber and its combustibility as to what they'll allow. How are you finding that experience as a, say, as a practice? You have a practice called Matiforma, which I presume attempts to do some of these mass timber projects in 3D. And I'm wondering if you're encountering that either, as an architect or in your research, that the code and the fire protection community is coming around to the idea that mass timber is a viable product.
Yeah, definitely. The thing with building code that is really interesting to me that I, as a student of architecture, I just had no idea about this side of the practice of the discipline, is that every city, every jurisdiction has its own, fire marshal. Every jurisdiction has its own building code and ordinances. And that means that every jurisdiction has to decide whether to adopt the Mass Timber Update, which is 2021 IBC. And so it's not, even though it's international building code, it's not international in its adoption, right? And any kind of adoption requires the whole Department of Buildings, the DOP, DOB, to be retrained, which is a massive investment. In the in especially in a small community, that can be, I mean, even in New York, they didn't do it. They adopted like 4,000 ordinances before adopting 2021. I don't even think they have adopted 2021 IBC yet. I think it's still on 2014 plus thousands of ordinances that you have to sort through. And one of those a section of those ordinances that they adopted included that paved the way for mass timber to be implemented in a really an amazing way, because most buildings in New York aren't super talls. They're actually probably like 3 to 8 story buildings. All of the five boroughs are kind of covered in this mid-rise typology. And so that adoption was really huge for, the mass timber being part of New York City. But then the next kind of adoption beyond height would be what you're describing as fire protection. And a lot of the design of the fire protection, like you're saying, is a conversation with the folks that are understanding how to inspect it. Someone that comes to a building site and doesn't know whether the design has achieved the correct fire protection rating because they've never seen mass timber before, that can be really scary for them. That can be really risky. So they're having to like relearn or, learn for the first time how these assemblies function. And they're learning those things as research is being done in this field. So the research of fire protection provided by mass timber is ongoing. This industry is so new that it's not that it's been already completed. And so the research has to flow, to these people who are assessing whether it's too risky or too new or too novel to, do it at this point in time for them. And then what I also write in the book, I just love to learn about how, let's say, like fire marshals make their assessment. It's also very bespoke. You know, who is on our team? What is their level of training? If you have a big team full of young people, you're going to take less risks. So it's you know, how long are our ladders? How big are our trucks? You know, how robust is our timing and all of our infrastructure? So I think after, you know, I wrote the book and researched really what does it mean to change the code, I just have so much respect for the folks that are trying to take these steps forward towards a new material era in all of the sense of the word, because it is really a people problem, you know, getting thousands of people on the same page in a city. So for example, the Milwaukee high-rise, you know, that was a project that was not an as of right project as of 2021 IBC. It was a process of rewriting the code specifically for that building. And I don't claim to know all of, I was not on that project, but it was such a good example for how people can work directly with the DOB and with the fire marshal, and find a really good place of comfort for everyone. But very bespoke, you know, not a path that could easily be followed, actually. So there are some challenges, I think, you know, but it's tough to say it's one thing or the other. It's really about relationships when you're starting a project, and going through a project and getting the right people on your design team. So getting the right, let's say, code experts. Mass timber code experts are a fantastic resource for a project. And then talking to the right people in the city, in the jurisdiction that you're working with, having them on board from the beginning. So you never really want to go through design and then talk to them. They will be really upset by that. And you'll have bad information, you know, if you have to incorporate what their feelings are and really work together on moving forward. So yeah, in my practice at Matterforma, we have a handful of mass timber projects. You know, one of them is, you know, none of them are actually, we have one possible high rise that we're, you know, considering, but it's really early days. And most of them are, you know, within the realm of like low to mid rise, like I mentioned. So height is never really the debate. It's much more the assembly, and what that means is allowing the wood to be exposed and to be considered, you know, fireproof because it's massive. So the belief that charring will protect the structure is the real challenge at hand. And you know, not only with the building department, but also with insurance companies. So when you go to the International Mass Timber Conference, for example, you know, they have these amazing classes that are just for fire marshals and insurance providers. They go to the class. And you know what, I love going to those, and hearing from everyone, you know, what are their doubts, what are their worries. And in both cases, there's this lack of trust when it comes to different studies that have been done. They really, it's most often people really want to see it for themselves. So you have to constantly be, let's say, doing these full-scale prototypes, you know, that are showing how fire operates in a mass timber structure, inviting folks across the industry to come to witness it. Because when you witness it with your own eyes, that's when things really change. And so softwood lumber board has been doing a lot of those, has been leading a lot of those efforts, either doing them themselves or investing in people who are doing them. So that kind of momentum is also really helpful. It's just, you know, the AEC industry is so slow because it just involves so many people. And you know, it's actually one of the reasons why I love architecture as opposed to Like, I consider myself a true architect as opposed to like an artist, because architecture requires like a lot of people to come together. Like, architecture requires consensus as opposed to like personal expression. And it's that consensus that I think is just so powerful and has the potential to really change the future when we all agree that something is worth doing.
Oh, and that's a really optimistic sentiment too, for describing something that a lot of people when they encounter it in the real world after they've gone through architecture school and realize that, oh my gosh, I have to get the same idea past all these people and get them all into agreement, and it's my idea is going to be so distorted by the time I get to the other side. And you just sort of have to accept that that's a process. And then of course, now, when you're introducing a new material that people are skittish about, that's just another layer of bureaucratic entanglement and negotiation. And so the people skills that come into play there are, I think, underappreciated, because the stories we end up hearing, I just went on the, I live in Oak Park, and so I just went on this, the Frank Lloyd Wright house tour, and it's all about the great ideas that Frank Lloyd Wright had, and how strong-willed he was, and how he bullied his clients, and it is so not the typical situation. So it's just fun to hear about like the real story of how buildings get built. I did think that that story of the Ascent, the building you referred to in Milwaukee, was interesting, because a lot of fortunate accidents actually came together into one place, that the fire chief there happened to have previously worked with the Forest Service, and he was a forester. So he not only understood how buildings burnt, but he understood how timber and wood and virgin wood behaves. And so it was a lot easier, I think, to convince him, okay, the charring effect will allow them to structurally preserve the building as a 3-hour, fire protection strategy, versus somebody who was used to seeing, stick frame houses go up in flames. So I guess my question would be to you, what have your sort of negotiations been like, besides publishing this book and trying to convince people that there's a new verticality that can be applied to this industry and to this process of building? What kind of encounters have you had, and especially if in trying to get projects approved and built?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm glad you shared that about Ascent too. I think it's an amazing, like, people make such an impact. Like, the fire marshal is such a it is he's one, they're one person, and their decisions and way of thinking has such a massive impact in the world. And I agree that a lot of folks, especially in our political climate and our and within the climate of climate change, can graduate from university feeling really like ill-equipped or really not empowered to do much in this industry because it is so slow moving and because there are so many people involved. But what a great example, I think, of the impact you can have down the road. Yeah, the question is, what kinds of conversations or persuasive conversations have I kind of been involved in besides the book? And when we work on our projects, our project, let's say in Arizona, is a hospitality project that'll utilize mass timber, but really low density, low rise structures. And the reason that we're engaging mass timber there is because it's a really remote site, and we're, tapping into the value of, prefabrication in one way or another. Looking at sourcing wood from the Southwest, which is a lot of, interesting conversations have come up. Oh, why would you do wood in the desert? I love that question. So trees grow in a lot of different places, and Arizona is not just a desert. But that's one of the, conversations we'll be having. But it's still really early days, and one of the so right now we're in the site strategy phase, so we haven't really started even the architectural scope. We're looking at a PAD, you know, application, so a planned area development for the site. And so it just, you know, it's little by little, we're working on this project. And even in these early stages of design and site strategizing, one of the first things we did was engage a fire marshal. That was the first step we took. And of course, you know, the planning department and the building department to introduce ourselves. But those relationships are so important for the future. In fact, we engaged the fire marshal so early that that fire marshal actually retired by the time we needed them to visit us on site. And then we had a new fire marshal, you know, join the team. And it was really interesting for, you know, me and my team to see how different one fire marshal might approach a project from another. And that was a big part of our process, was, you know, asking questions again, understanding their comfort level, understanding their interpretation of the code. And, you know, I think that's what I'm learning, you know, out in Arizona, at least, is that there's this real sense of, let's say, listening that goes a long way. So if we assume, you know, if we try to rush somebody through their assessment, you always just get the code thrown at you. I mean, right? Because people don't like to be treated like robots. People don't like to be, you know, rushed and to not have a conversation or relationship. And so I teach my staff, and, you know, I myself have to kind of keep practicing this idea of it's an ongoing conversation. We're really trying to meet everyone where they are and understand what their motivations are and understand, you know, what's behind their interpretation. And those, that kind of approach, that's, it's never a closed book. It's always open and it's always changing, can be difficult to track and predict, but it can result in some really helpful trade-offs. So, for example, we were able to get a few of the road requirements, which they should be like 26 feet wide, and we got them down to 12 feet wide. So that's a huge win. So there are different little things here and there that we, you know, see happening through those relationships. But that's not really about mass timber. That's just more about design. But it could definitely happen with mass timber, I think, that's for sure. Another thought, another persuasive event or moment that came to mind when you asked that question is when I speak at wood-oriented events. So everyone in the audience is coming there to because they're already in the industry. So it's not a general public audience. It's very much folks that own sawmills, that own forests, that work at manufacturing facilities and are trying to understand where they fit in the world, what the future of mass timber is, what the future of wood is. And one of the most surprising things I've encountered is doubt in that group. So doubt that mass timber or wood in general can be healthy. This was so shocking to me, and in my typical kind of keynote speech, I usually introduce the concept of mass timber at the beginning, and then I stop and I open it up for the audience to share their doubts. You know, what does everyone think about this? I want to hear just, you know, unfiltered doubts. And a lot of people will eventually share that they're just worried about massive deforestation. They're worried that buildings will burn down. It becomes very general public very fast, even though they're working in the industry. And so, you know, one of the I really enjoy those moments a lot, because I think that wood industry people can do a better job not greenwashing or sugarcoating the issues and really addressing those concerns. They're like really challenging concerns. How do you guarantee that this won't result in deforestation. You know, it's a political, social, complex web of things, and there's really no guarantee to any future anyways. And so those conversations, I think, should be happening more, really like taking the criticism head on. and then another thought to add to that is that wood is somehow held to this higher standard, you know, than other building materials. Nobody is interrogating, you know, where did this aggregate come from for this concrete? Which island which island was, you know, harvested for the sand in this concrete? Which territory is no longer in existence so that I could have the sand for this concrete? Which lime mine was tapped into? Where did this bauxite come from? Where did the aluminum come from? Which bauxite mine? Like, what are the conditions there? Like, nobody's really, you know, having an apples to apples critique. You know, it's just easier to imagine a status quo continuing than to build this new infrastructure called, like, you know, a resilient timber supply chain. So when folks are, I mean, even in, like, I just did an AIA keynote, architects, you know, were the most suspicious. And we're really worried about deforestation. And I don't know, in my opinion, it's very simple. Either you're regrowing your materials or you're not. And that's the choice. Either you're getting them from a forest or a mine. And, you know, mining is just so not futuristic. I don't know. It's just not cyclical. It's a one-way street. It's a linear process. So yeah, convincing people on cycles, I think, is another bigger challenge that I enjoy. And sometimes it comes up in a project, but those are much more abstract, I think. I know I've been rambling a little bit, but I join these, you know, I give keynotes. That's a kind of regular part of the business, is public speaking on this point. I've done around 35 lectures in the last year, public lectures on this topic. And I also am part of a few nonprofit groups. So, like, advocacy has grown out, like, a real true advocacy has grown out of the book to be a kind of consistent stream of work, sometimes income.
Yeah, it's great if advocacy can be a source of income. That's the best of all worlds. But obviously, it's a big part of the job, and you know, clearing the way for more work in the way that you want to work, you kind of have to do it. Well, I really want to thank you so much for spending the time with me today. Unfrozen is happy to have you, and hopefully, we'll be able to help you a little bit in your quest for advocacy to design the forest and our future built environment better. Lindsay Wiskstrom, thank you.
Thank you so much. This has been a thrill. Mm-hmm.